What a pleasure it is for Bill Russell and for me, Paula Gordon, to be with Paul Ekman, Dr. Ekman, who has done a lifetime of work around emotions in the human creature. I like to think of us as the human animal. Among the things that you have done and are doing, and even though you have been retired from the University of California, San Francisco now for 6 years, you are deeply engaged in the world and with the world, and particularly are learning from and, I dare say, teaching His Holiness the Dalai Lama as the two of you work together, which you render wonderfully in the book that you call Emotional Awareness. There are a lot of us who would like to live a better life, A, staying out of fights, and B, moving towards serenity, if you will, moving to a place where you feel that you know, this is better, that I don't have to just take what I was given when I was born, that I have some, I can touch who and what I am, that I have a role to play in myself. Now, there are those who say, no, you don't, and they're pretty rigorous about that. But you have real evidence, working specifically with His Holiness, that we do play a part in creating who we are, it micro, individually, inside our own little personage, as well as the species, which is no mean except the fact that the planet's in trouble because of our species, the evolution on both micro and macro. Where do we get a toehold on this kind of evidence that we can, in fact, influence who we are personally and who we are in as a species on the planet?
It's a very tough question.
Oh, well, yes.
And yet, there are two possibilities. One is, no, we can't. It's all... I mean, that's a fatalism. I think that works very well if you're living in a caste or feudal society. You clearly can't do much about it. It really doesn't work at all for societies in which there's any individual freedom, where you do have a choice as to what you're going to do to some extent.
I mean, and who you're going to be?
And who you're going to be and what your obligations are to your fellow human beings.
And the planet.
And to the planet. And to your offspring. Your intellectual offspring, if you are a teacher. Your biological offspring, if you're a parent. I've thought that becoming a parent really mortgages you to life after your death. You care now, not just that it's a good place for you, but it's a good place for the next generation, who you've put a lot of time into, and that's why the species continues. And if we didn't care about the next generation, then these troublesome, wailing infants, we wouldn't invest in them, and we put an enormous investment in them, and we do it usually, for most of us, without consideration. In fact, we're impelled. Most of us, not all of us. I mean, natural selection cannot work without variation. So on any human characteristic you can think of that has a social significance or a biological significance, there's going to be variations. You never know what's going to fit this particular changing environmental niche. That's why humans can live in the most diverse environments of any animal. But the price of that is that we have the longest period of dependency. In humans, a long time that offspring is not going to survive unless you take care of them and teach them. But that means there's this enormous open period to kind of create what goes into the brain.
Is that like the open period between stimulus and the ability to respond?
Well, you may learn that ability, but you usually going to have to do work considerably later in your life to acquire that.
But it's that same sort of idea that if you get into those spaces that are available, you can do things.
You can do things. Now, I said before there are two choices. One is the fatalistic one. The other one is individual action and efficacy. The Dalai Lama says, I don't know whether reincarnation is true. How would I know? It's just what I believe. And I say to him, well, I don't believe there is any reincarnation or any form of afterlife, but how can I be certain I'm not dead, right? When I'm dead, then I'll be certain. If I was wrong, I'll be certain, because I'll think, oh my God, I'm dead and I'm still alive in some way. My mind is still there. He said to me, if you can prove that there is no, that when the brain is dead, there is no mind, I won't be a Buddhist. Because it's central to Buddhism to think the mind continues in some form. That's the spiritual and more Christian or Jewish world. Of course, I think that that's absolutely the case. And I said, you know, 50 years from now, nobody would ever say what you're saying right now. It'll be so certain. The mind is just a metaphor and simple way of talking about some of the activities of the brain, the ones that we're most aware of. But let's go back and say we can't be absolutely certain. Is it all out of our hands or is it all in our hands? Of course, it's somewhere in between. But what's the better way to lead your life? Make your bets. You may as well bet that it's in your hands. Then it's not in your hands. Because then you're going to at least make a try. You're going to try to do something. And, you know, although historians argue whether it's the hero or history, there's just, I think, no question that individually, you don't have to be the most talented person in the world to make a difference. You can make a difference, he believes, step by step, person by person. The Buddhists like to talk about the story of, I wish I had this bit down better, but I just heard it again yesterday from Matthew Ricard, there's a terrible forest fire. And all of the animals have gotten to the edge of the fire. And there's this little hummingbird that is flying over to the ocean, picking up a drop of water in its beak, flying back and dropping it on the fire. One drop at a time. And if all of us do things one drop at a time, do the best that we can do, then we'll create a better world for everyone.
You say that His Holiness believes that. Do you believe that?
That each individual can make a difference? Yes. The nature of the difference is going to depend on the individual. But all of us, you know, I think one of the emotions I named in the book before the one with the Dalai Lama is
Emotions Revealed.
And in it, I name an emotion that's not named in the English language. There are quite a few of them, actually. My favorite one is one that's only named in Yiddish, Nachas, which is that enormous pride you feel in the accomplishment of your offspring, when they stand on your shoulders, when you enable them. And I think it's fundamental to human survival and to parenting, because it feels good when you see your... When I first told the Dalai Lama about this, he said, oh, but it's just for your child, it's selfish. I said, no, it's for all children. That when I see another child get up on the stage and do something wonderful, I get that same feeling. And in that sense, becoming a parent makes you a parent to all children. Your heart is open to these vulnerable young creatures who you want to help enable. Great thing. The second one we all know, Schadenfreude, the pleasure we take in hearing about the miseries of the people we don't like.
Which is why we gossip.
That's right. We're not supposed to enjoy this, but it has its own sweetness. And it's interesting that the Germans have a name for it.
Oh, dear.
And we don't have a single word for it in English. And the third one, which is how I got started on this, is what the Italians call fiero. And it's this feeling when I've stretched myself to my limit and done it. I get this when I get a sentence that sings. And sometimes they just come one after another. Sometimes I can work all day until I finally get a sentence that works, and it feels great. It's not competing with someone else. It's all within me. It's an athlete feels that when they get their best performance. Now, my best writing is not the equal of Philip Roth's best writing. He gets that same experience when he stretches himself that I get when I stretch myself. And that's what all of us can get, that enjoyment. And the wonderful thing about it is it's good for everyone, because you've done the best of what you can do with who you are.
Fiero.
Fiero.
We should hold that one. As you were talking, you said balance, and it took my mind and eyes right back to the subtitle of Emotional Awareness, which is Overcoming the Obstacles to Psychological Balance and Compassion. Yeah. Balance in all these things of which you speak is really important, isn't it?
It's pivotal, which is a balance term, right? Balance on that pivot. And how do you achieve balance in your life? Work and family, entertainment, investment in your life, in the lives of others. These are all, when you're out of balance, one part is, to be totally concerned, to be in denial of the self for the service of others is to be out of balance too. And you certainly don't see that in the Dalai Lama.
He gets 9 hours sleep a night.
And he loves to eat. And he said today, most of the time what's important is quality, not quantity. But for food, it's quantity, especially for me. He loves to eat.
People are always so surprised that he has a wonderful sense of humor, heard. Isn't that part of this balance thing?
Yes, I've never laughed so much in my life as in the 40 hours we spent conversation. Now, the meeting today, there were only a few jokes because there was so much time pressure.
Mm. Maybe there's a lesson in that, too.
There is, which is that if I really want to continue the conversation with him, and I'm not certain where, if there is another place to go, because there are some conversations that end, where you've talked about everything that you really have. You like each other, so you like to see each other, but you don't really have some new area to explore.
And time is all we have.
The older we get, the less we've got ahead of us. We don't know how much, but we certainly know we're in the last phase. We are not accustomed to the idea of limits, but that's the nature of life. Oh, I have a wonderful story. One of our disagreements.
Yours and?
The Dalai Lama's. If you notice, I'm not calling him His Holiness. And I can't do that because I don't regard him as holy. And he's an extraordinary person. I admire him. I enjoy him. But he's a person. And that very term, His Holiness, was adopted by his advisors for him to use when he had to go out in the world. And where do you think they got it? They thought, the closest to him is the Pope. Well, he is so unlike, not to demean the Pope, but there is no dogma. He is a monk, and he has, and what he says is what the Buddha says, if what I tell you doesn't work for you, reject it. That is not what you hear from the Pope. You hear the word of God from the Pope, and you are supposed to follow it without question. So that's the second reason. Not only do I not leave anyone, I can't conceive of calling him the same name that you call the Pope.
I think you have just corrected me, and I stand corrected, and I thank you.
How's that?
I will call him the Dalai Lama.
Right. So now, but the problem with calling him the Dalai Lama would be like calling me Professor. Hmm. You could call me Professor, but then it's a little bit of a distance term. Mm-hmm. Now, students and people do call me Professor who don't know me, but my friends don't call me Professor. And he doesn't. He calls me Paul.
And you call him?
My dear friend. I was hoping that this time I would be willing to say Tenzin.
Could you do it?
I didn't do it. I just said my dear friend. Next time. There is a next time. I would have done it if these nasty people weren't in the room.
This, again, is balance, though, isn't it?
I knew that they would think I was so disrespectful that I didn't want to. They're already mad at me for taking up his time. Even though his most senior people know he loves to talk with me, and it's good for him. He laughs all the time. I don't tell jokes, but...
But you're funny.
Right, I guess so. I've never had so much fun as talking with him. The Now, that was the dollar. There was another story, and I've lost what it was.
Let me filibuster. This is one of the challenges of language that we come up against. We create these abstractions, these symbols, and then we treat them as if they are real. I have no problem with His Holiness in the first sense, because I figure it's His Holiness, is not mine.
And we all are holy.
Now, having raised the second one, I am now going to have to rethink my term of reference. And I think maybe Paul's good friend.
Well, you've got the other thing, and that is, do you treat anyone reverentially?
Uh-huh.
Deferentially.
And Jesus said, don't do that.
And He doesn't like it either.
Right.
In fact, one of the reasons we get along so well is we like to challenge each other.
Mm-hmm.
And He knows that He can challenge me as much as He wants. I'll love it, and I will challenge Him as much as I possibly can. And He loves it.
And you love each other.
That's right.
And that's the balance of which we were speaking. Let us go away for just a moment, and we'll be back shortly with Paul Ekman, and in a wonderful echo kind of way, since Paul Ekman spent the morning with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and you can call him anything you want, Paul Ekman's good friend. Please be with us when we return.